welcome to this bonus episode of the EMG Health podcast. Today's episode is a review of the symposium Harvesting the Fruits of Pulmonary Disease Research, Learnings from the COVID-19 Pandemic, that took place at the recent European Respiratory Society's International Congress 2021. This episode has been funded by CSL Behring. Stay tuned to hear from two experts in pulmonary disease, Professor Felix Hirth and Dr. Dave Singh. Professor Hirth is going to cover the impact of COVID-19 on patients with AATD, whereas Dr. Singh will explore concomitant pulmonary disease as a risk factor in severe COVID-19 infections, as well as how to manage and prevent severe cases. It is a timely and important episode, so do sit back and enjoy.
Hello, everybody, dear friends, dear colleagues. My name is Felix Hirth. I'm from the University of Heidelberg, working as a respiratory physician, and it's a pleasure to have to be part of that podcast with my good friend Dave Singh.
Felix, hi, good to be here with you today. Just a quick introduction for the audience. My name is Dave Singh. I work in the University of Manchester. I'm a professor of clinical pharmacology and respiratory medicine. I very much enjoyed attending the ERS recently and had the great pleasure of being part of this symposium that we're about to discuss. And Felix, I want to kick off the discussion by getting your views on some of the aspects discussed around alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. I think you alluded to, well, the speakers alluded to research priorities changing. Can you give us your overview of that? What's happened there?
Yeah, Dave, sure. I think it was a great symposium, and we always came to the same summary that we have to bundle our research activities really to get more insight of the disease, to get a clear guidance in the diagnostic as well in the therapeutic options, and therefore I think the European Alpha-1 Research Collaboration, the EARCO, is a great idea. We're talking about a rare disease. Everybody's agreeing on that. And when every single institution tries to come up with their research plans, we always end up with small numbers of patients. So therefore, bringing the researchers, and especially the next generation of researchers, in a more collaborative way to working on that EARCO umbrella will for sure help us to get more of those patients diagnosed, treated, and followed up in a more structured way, to get more insights in the disease and to understand maybe things better we actually do not really understand.
I think this sounds fantastic, because in all diseases, the number of times we see small studies with unclear results because of sample size, I assume this is one of the key things you want to do better by bringing everybody together and produce large clinical research data sets.
Yeah, for sure. You see, just for example, when you look to the actual EARCO research plans, initially it was a little bit of a way you only have to screen for the alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency when the CBD patient is younger or when the CBD patient have a low predominant emphysema. We learned that doesn't make sense. We have to test every patient when we come up with the diagnosis of a CBD at the time of the initial diagnosis. And now we learned that there are other diseases where alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency plays an important role, like bronchiectasis or like asthma in a more adult population. So therefore, the EARCO really gives us the possibility to do it together, to figure out in which subset of other lung diseases we have to think about that differential diagnosis. And especially living in the COVID-19 pandemic area or time, we have to do research on the protein for options for our alpha-1 patients suffering on COVID and the risk of being a COVID positive candidate, but also of the role in of the protein as an option for in a case you are infected by the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
So Felix, I think you've raised a number of interesting and important issues there. So most respiratory physicians looking after, I think you mentioned asthma, there's also bronchiectasis, they wouldn't think of testing for alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. And how will you change this process and mindset in the future?
Yeah, Dave, this is, I think, a question we're trying to solve since we're knowing about the disease. We're knowing it's a rare disease. We're knowing it's predominantly ending up in an emphysema patient. And therefore, the recommendation since the first gold paper come out and also the national COPD guidelines or recommendations, it's always published that when you diagnose a COPD, you should go for the testing if the patient has that rare reason for being a COPD patient. So it's repeating education to all of our colleagues. For sure, I can understand when you would work as a GP, then it's really rare that you see in your career even one alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency patient. But it's important that you do it in every patient. And therefore, we really have seen an amazing improvement in the testing. Nowadays, it's only the blood level you have to examine in most of the European countries that is reimbursed by the insurance system. So it's just a blood examination. When I remember when I was a younger fellow, we did the electrophoresis and we looked to the alpha peak and everything. So that was complicated and maybe also boring. And this was a reason why we never liked that. But now we have the blood level, easy test, you sample blood, send it to the lab and you get your information. So therefore, I think it's awareness. This is why we're doing symposias, why we're doing research, or why we're doing that podcast. Just think about that rare reason for COPD and do it in every COPD patient. In my institution, we established that. So we're having in the medical report as a diagnosis that the next person who sees that patient or the next doctor sees that patient knows we measured it, we thought about, and it's negative or it's positive.
Yeah, you reminding us about a paper electrophoresis takes us back a while, and you're absolutely right. The quantitative methods we have now have moved on a long way. Have you got any practical tips for people working in different centres with different diagnostic testing methods about interpretation of the results they get, and maybe when there's quantification below the normal range, what should people do?
Yeah, for sure. You see, you always have to think about it's an acute inflammatory marker. So we measure the CRP level to be sure that it's not influenced by an inflammation. But in case you have a level which is below normal, and this is something, there are different companies offering the test, but normally it's 0.8. Then you have to go for the genetic testing. But even for the genetic testing, this has been improved a lot in the last decade. And even we have mostly national-based central labs who can do the phenotyping for you. So there in Germany, for example, because I'm German, it's Marburg. So when we have a level below the threshold, we sample blood and send it to Marburg. You can use dry blood samples. You just put on a piece of paper and this is coming. We're getting those boxes from Marburg. We're just putting a blood drop on, or we also can do it now with swabs from the mucosa, from the mouth, and then we send it in and then you get the results. So, and I know this is possible in most of the European countries that we have the labs, and then you get that information. And for example, in Germany, this is free. Nobody is for free. Nobody have to pay for. So it's supported by research grants. So really when the threshold in the blood you can sample on your local level is below what you should see, then just go and do the phenotyping of the disease to exclude or to diagnose S and Z alleles.
So it's great to hear about this centralized testing, which is present in a reasonable number of countries. Have you any comment on the reproducibility and reliability of the results? From what I understand, it's really very good.
Yeah, this is a very important question, Dave. Therefore, it's really a must that you send it in your national reference lab, yeah? Because all the bigger labs, they are connecting, they're doing quality measurements, they have quality structures behind, so you can be sure that the results you get are really results you can trust. I know there are also commercial labs who are doing that, but I would not trust that. So therefore, even to have information about the different alleles, and we have seen a lot of additional alleles by having more molecular options, I really would say send it to your national reference lab, then you can trust what you get. And then it's your decision with the patient when to treat, and all those treatment-related questions. But the test results I have seen in my career have been always true.
So that's really fantastic to hear about the tests we have available now. I think then the challenge is, as you said earlier, let's find all the patients and make sure it's at the top of all healthcare professionals, particularly respiratory physicians, at the front of their thoughts, also primary care, to make sure that we do the testing. Felix, can I move us on now? You mentioned COVID-19 earlier. What impact has COVID-19 had on the management of patients with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency?
To be honest, this has been a complicated time for everybody, for us as well, for our patients. First of all, initially, nobody, when it came to the first wave, initially, nobody knows what that means. And then it was quickly also public available that COPD, and this is the diagnosis all my patients have, that COPD is a risk factor to going to a severe course of the infection. So therefore, unfortunately, a lot of my patients stopped their augmentation therapy because they have clear fear to have contact with the health system, because the COVID-infected patients have to come to us. So we have seen those patients. And then when you have to come in my outpatient clinic to get your weekly infusion, no. And maybe a patient next to me is COVID positive. I'm a risk patient. I don't want to see that. So a lot of patients stopped augmentation therapy. I think this, we also have seen in other diseases, we have a delayed diagnosis in lung cancer. We have delayed diagnosis of that and that. I think the patients have not been willing to come in contact with the health system. They have been nervous to get infectious. So therefore, I think one of what we really have seen, because we started in 2019 our self-augmentation program. So we trained the patient. The patient have to go to, in means, 3 sessions, and then they are able to do everything on their own at home. And by the help of, also to mention that, of CSL Behring, we produced a lot of video material. So we did also online trainings, and we have offered trainings at the patient coming to in specific time slot to the hospital. So we moved a couple of patients from the IV augmentation in a center to their home augmentation, which helps them to continue their treatment, because we have good data, especially from Ireland, where they stopped the treatment, where they stopped augmentation therapy due to the missing reimbursement. When you are on the therapy and you stop it, then you directly get exacerbation. So therefore, we change our augmentation in a way that the patient are doing more and more home therapy on their own. And luckily, it worked well. As mentioned, we have had good training material, and the patient understood that they need the training. So even therefore, I think for all those alpha patients, it's important that they have contact to a center where they're getting all those information they needed to be treated also in those areas, in those times which are more complicated. So we did a lot of self-augmentation.
That's a real achievement, being able to get patients to do this themselves. Can you give us an idea what proportion of your patients are able to self-administer? Is it a small group or is it the majority of your patients?
No, to be honest, it's not the majority. But 40% of my patients are now on self-augmentation. So they're doing that at home. There are multiple reasons. So in Germany, it's not so complicated to find a doctor around your home. So, but they say, especially when they are younger, they say, okay, I don't have to come during the office time because I'm still fully employed. I can do it on the weekend or I can do it in the evening at home. I can do it during my vacation. So there are a lot of factors which they learned due to the pandemic and they like now. So they're continuing with that. But we also have, on the other hand, older patients. We have patients who don't want to stitch a needle in their own venous system. So it's not the majority, but we're working on that. It's half-half.
So you mentioned earlier, Felix, that some of your, or many of your patients didn't want to come near the hospital. And I think that for all COPD patients led to an interesting observation at the start of the pandemic that there were less COPD hospitalizations. So COPD patients were avoiding hospital, and this made us think perhaps they were exacerbating less. But actually, the early data that came out made us learn that COPD patients had worse outcomes from COVID-19. Have you any experience of alpha-1 antitrypsin patients contracting COVID-19 and any stories about their clinical course?
Yeah, so luckily we only have had one alpha patient who have been infected by COVID-19, and that patient was diagnosed quite early and he was two days hospitalized, but he recovered then quickly, for sure. There are reports that the patient getting infected, but at the end, it's not. I don't have the impression that it's more than be having a COPD. So it's more that having a COPD, and this is a isolated risk factor. But you mentioned the exacerbation. What we have seen in the maybe you have the same opinion, the same situation in the UK. So the numbers of exacerbation went down to the COVID time because everybody's wearing the mask and we washing our hands maybe more often, doing that in a better and a preciser way. So the numbers of exacerbation, not only in COPD, but also in interstitial lung disease, in cystic fibrosis, went down since we have other behavior measurements. And I don't know, you have seen the same in your institution?
Yes, Felix, we see the same, that for many COPD patients, the exacerbation rate has gone down. But I would divide the patients broadly into two. One group of patients with less viral infections, and as you say, more, they avoid, they social isolation, hand washing, and generally they've had a better time. But then there's also another group of patients who've become deconditioned. So I think in COPD, physical activity is tremendously important. And I personally have been in contact with a number of patients who are so scared to go out of their house, they've put weight on, they've lost muscle strength. And I think this is a real issue. It's a byproduct of the pandemic.
So maybe, Dave, you have been heavily involved in all those trials you run in the UK, and I really have to congratulate you, not to the Brexit, but the structure. You have been enrolled COVID patient in multiple clinical trials in the UK was really impressive. So what are your learnings from the pandemic? What you learned, what you think when we would be infected today, is what we have actual as therapeutic options for COVID-19 patients.
So yeah, thanks, Felix, for the positive comments. We have a lot more options now, and we learn about the efficacy of these from doing really large clinical trials. I think during the pandemic, there's a place for smaller studies, and they have to run at the same time as the large confirmatory phase 3 studies. And this is a really important point to make, because the large phase 3 studies, so recovery, they showed us clearly that COVID-19 patients who are hospitalized and are hypoxic or on mechanical ventilation, they have better outcomes with dexamethasone. And also the recovery study showed us that that group of patients with a high CRP, so a high inflammatory load, the anti-IL-6 therapy in addition to steroids can be successful. So these were absolutely key studies. Now, alongside vaccination, I think these put us in a better place. But overall, we're seeing that although in many countries we have lots of cases in the community, the number of deaths is now under control because of vaccination and because when you go into hospital, these therapies are available. But at the same time, it's important that we have research on therapies that are novel and they are targeted at the inflammatory processes or antiviral processes during COVID-19. So I think we did well in managing to do all this research at the same time across the world and develop some of the drugs, particularly vaccines and the antibodies now that you can use for people who have COVID but have maybe not been vaccinated but are hospitalized. So I think it's been a tremendous achievement in a short space of time. One message I would give, though, is personalized therapy. And while the large trials have been successful in either proving that a medicine works, and I named some that worked, or disproving, so for example, hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, they clearly prove that they don't work. We are moving towards what I would say is a personalized therapy regime for COVID-19. So for example, very straightforward, what I mentioned earlier, that dexamethasone only works if the patient's hypoxic, and anti-IL-6 has efficacy if you have a high CRP. So it's important that we learn more about the disease itself, because then targeted therapies will be more successful. So I think the problem of endothelial disease in COVID-19 has not been solved. And having biomarkers or ways to understand who has a burden of endothelial disease, and it might be imaging, then having therapies that can address these issues. There's also a really neat phase 2 study done in Holland, and I really like this study. So imatinib, tyrosine kinase inhibitor, in patients hospitalized with COVID-19, and it showed a reduction in mortality. So how does this work? It stops vascular leak. You know, that's what I was mentioning about how you identify these patients. And so clearly a therapy like this is going to work in patients who have that type of process going on. And I think we talk about personalized medicine in a lot of respiratory disease, and I think COVID-19 therapeutics is going that way. I don't know how you see it, Felix.
I completely agree. I think we see different types of patients. We're using the WHO classification, and we really have to look for biomarkers, or as you mentioned, maybe for imaging markers, to figure out which patient is a candidate for whatever, and that we really can keep them, first of all, alive and keep them away from the ICUs, which means keep them alive. So therefore, I think what you showed, what I already mentioned, UK, really when you are able to do it nationwide, then you really can do it in a structured way, and you can then at the end compare the data and you can come up with clear recommendations. So therefore, when I compare it, even it's not comparable, the EACO is hopefully doing the same what you in the UK showed us you can do when you do it in a structured way in a pandemic situation. Yeah. So therefore, Dave, I think we learned a lot. We still have to learn even more to understand more the disease, but it was great to chat with you. Chat with Dave, yeah, was really great. I think For those colleagues who are interested in the whole symposium we have had together, where we talked about how to diagnose also our alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency patient, how to treat them, how self-augmentation works, but also having that keynote lecture from you, Dave, about what we learned from COVID-19. Just go to the ERS website. You are able to look or to hear that recorded video. And therefore, Dave, I want to thank you for that nice chat. I think it was really interactive, and hopefully by having awareness activities like that, we can convince our colleagues to enroll patients into nationwide running trials. And for those who are diagnosing COPD, just think about that you should test for alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, because for those patients, we knowing what we can offer for therapeutic standpoint. So therefore, thanks, Dave. I wish you all the best. Hopefully we don't have to go to a fifth wave. We always look into the UK, because you are way more opening than the Germans doing that. We are a little bit more conservative. Yeah, but hopefully we have a healthy summer, a healthy winter for everybody. And I think, don't forget the vaccination for the flu. That might be the next problem.
Thank you, Felix. A great summary. And you stay healthy as well. And thank you to everyone for listening.
Bye-bye.
And that concludes our podcast on the ERS International Congress Symposium covering pulmonary disease and COVID-19. A big thank you to CSL Behring for funding this episode, and to our two experts, Professor Felix Hirth and Dr. Dave Singh, for sharing their thoughts and insight. If you found this episode insightful, do head over to our podcast hub at www.emghealth.com, where we have plenty of other episodes like this. Or be sure to subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.